Swiss by Design is brought to you by Karen Millen Boutique, fashion for women, 7 Cours de Rive, Geneva.
Welcome to Swiss by Design with Jennifer Davies on World Radio Switzerland. Each week, Swiss by Design reveals the cultural life of Switzerland, looking at art, architecture and design. And we also highlight the top artistic events across the nation. Today, we'll be talking to the co-director of Art Basel as the event opens in Miami Beach. We look at design after death with a creator of contemporary urns. We hear from Runa Islam, the Turner Prize nominee, whose films are on show in Switzerland. And we speak to the architects behind the country's most energy-efficient offices in Fribourg. Now, after nearly 40 years, the annual Art Basel event has, many suggest, catapulted the city's profile as a mecca for those contemporary art aficionados who come from around the world to see what's on offer. Over the last few years, the event has held a sister show in the Art Deco district of Miami. This week, Art Basel Miami Beach opens its doors to art lovers stateside. With more than 250 galleries from North and Latin America, Europe, Asia and Africa, exhibiting 20th and 21st century artworks by more than 2,000 artists. Special exhibition sections feature young galleries, performance art, public art projects and video art. I caught Art Basel's new co-director, Mark Spiegler, a former art critic and journalist, just before he jetted off to the States to discuss how this event has managed to live long and prosper where others have fallen by the wayside.
I'm actually a dual national French and American, and I spent virtually every summer of my childhood and adolescence in Alsace. The region was very familiar to me. In fact, when I was a kid, I would go to visit my grandparents and stay in Colmar, and then when I got bored there, as one tends to do, I would go to Basel as the closest big city.
So really, Basel has a very special significance for you.
Yeah, strangely enough, I ended up as the co-director of an art show in the city where I had some of my earliest museum experiences. I remember going to see the Tingley sculptures at the Kunstmuseum in Basel when I was perhaps 10 or 12. And of course, you know, all the old masters.
Tell me, how did you go from being a journalist to the co-director of the most prestigious art event in the world?
I was an art journalist for more than 10 years, and of course that meant that I did a lot of thinking about what was going on within the art world, and I found there were a lot of different factions. There was one faction that was very speculative and oriented towards getting the highest prices possible out of the art in the fastest way possible, usually by selling it at auction. And there was another faction that I think was less commercial and less about the short-term profits and more about building the sustainable careers, and obviously that's the galleries. And so, although I had never even thought about working for Art Basel, when I was asked by the search committee that was replacing Sam Keller whether I would be willing to be a candidate, I thought about it for a little while and I said, this is actually a chance to work closely with the people who I think are essential to the art world developing in the way that I would like to see it develop. If the prospect of taking a new job doesn't scare you a little bit, you shouldn't take it.
I'm interested in talking to you about why there is an Art Miami. Of all the places in the world, Miami is perhaps associated with commercialism, with the art of sculpting great bodies, but not necessarily the art world.
There was a lot of skepticism when Art Basel announced that it was going to do a sister fair in Miami Beach, which is understandable given certain prejudices that people had about the greater Miami area. What people didn't know was that there is a really intense group of collectors. There was a very strong emergence of a Latin American collecting scene. There had been collectors in Latin America for a long time, but what was new was that many of them started reaching beyond Latin American art and into contemporary and modern art from around the world. So in a sense, the Miami area is the portal to Latin America. And that's been a very interesting development to watch because, first, of course, it put the major galleries of the world sort of on the doorstep of the Latin American market. And then, as a result, there was a second kind of wave of evolution within the Latin American market. And now I've been struck by this in my travels around the world. I meet a lot of collectors from places like Brazil or Argentina who did not start collecting until after Art Basel, Miami Beach. In other words, they went there because they had some interest in art, and then they caught the passion there. And so in a sense, we have not only the existing Latin American market, but I think we were instrumental in helping to develop a second wave within that market. And the other thing that I think was really important was the fact that Art Basel had the intention of going somewhere where we could have a real impact. And I think we certainly have had an impact there in the sense that the gallery scene is thriving in a way that it wasn't before, in the sense that artists are moving to Miami in a way that they weren't before, in the sense that the institutions are much stronger than they were before. Many of them are building, you know, whole new additions and extensions, or in fact, some cases, entirely new museums. The other interesting thing about this that people only realized later was that while it would seem logical to do an event like this in New York, in fact, in New York, there are far too many distractions. And if you look at where the most compelling contemporary art events take place, Art Basel, the Venice Biennial, Documenta in Kassel, these are not places that have a tremendously active year-round contemporary art scene. And I think in a way, it means that people are less distracted.
What are the next steps? How do we move forward with it?
Art Basel will move forward in the same way that it has always moved forward, which is to be true to this, the kind of DNA, which is the mix of modern, meaning anything post-1900, with super contemporary work. And on the other hand, by always tracking very closely what's happening within the art world so that it's evolving in a way which provides a platform for whatever is needed by the artists of that time. There are always changes. In every show, some galleries who have been there for a long time are no longer present, and some new galleries come in. I think there are a lot of strategies that a show such as ours could have taken in the face of the rapidly expanding art world that we saw within the last 10 years. One of them would have been to double the size of the show. And from a physical standpoint, we could have done that, especially in Basel, where the Messe Schweiz owns so many halls. The other tactic was to raise the bar. And that's what we chose to do. Rather than keeping the standard at the same level and thereby increasing the number of galleries, we simply raised the standard. So many galleries that were good enough to be in Art Basel 10 years ago are no longer present. And I think I always say, in the art world, if you stand still, you fall behind. And I think a lot of galleries with a lot of momentum have come into the show in the last 10 years or so. In a sense, it's the same strategy that a gallery could have taken with an artist whose notoriety is rising. Here you have two choices. You can raise the prices, or you can only sell to the best collectors, the best museums, the best institutions. So our strategy was to focus on exclusivity over commercialism. And I think for us, the question is always, what's next? And the answer is always, go look in the ateliers of the artists.
That was Mark Spiegler, the co-director of Art Basel and Art Basel Miami Beach, which runs until Sunday, the 7th of December, all through the Art Deco district. When we return, I'll be visiting the atelier of a designer of contemporary urns, whose work aims to challenge the way our society looks at death. So stay tuned to Swiss by Design until we come back. It seems that in today's secular and increasingly live-for-now society, for many, the subject of our own death or the passing of our loved ones simply isn't broached unless it becomes unavoidable. But that isn't the case in other cultures, where the life cycle is often discussed more openly. It's these issues that are the basis for Thomas Scheer's work as a designer of contemporary urns. His colourful handcrafted work for his company Cosmic Ball has been lauded by international design gurus like Karim Rashid, who incidentally owns a metallic pink model of the urn. Scheer incorporates philosophies from Japanese and African culture, and each piece reflects his desire to transform the image of the urn from a symbol of an individual's death to a personal and artistic representation of a person's life. I met with him in his Zurich studio, where he told me how he conceived of the idea.
It was in 1997 when I passed an undertaker and I looked into the shop window and I saw this quite ugly urns, and they were quite old-fashioned and tasteless, I would say. I said, kind of joking to my friend, yes, I really didn't want to end like that, and that was really the starting point, and I thought you should think about this topic and find new modern ways to develop a modern urn, to find new shapes, and why not working with colors. I wanted to keep it simple, so I choose very simple forms, and I started to design the first urn.
Because actually, if we take a look at your background a little bit, you were involved in art before then, weren't you?
Yes, I always was very interested in art, and that's my background. I see this collection as an art project. I try to make a modern statement about death and about urns.
What was the inspiration behind the ball shape particularly? Because we have here the ball of life, as you call them, and you also have the ball of love as well.
Yes, one idea is to express the idea of eternity and infinity, and life is also round. It has a beginning, a starting point, and it has an ending point. I do also some other shapes, like the cube. I have an urn called Mokyu, and it's made out of wood. And another form is called Yasura, and Yasura is a Japanese name. This is called Yabushi, and it means told story. It's also a Japanese name, and I would like to have the possibility that people can choose their very personal own design.
And so what's the philosophy behind Cosmic Ball? Because it's not just a question of the aesthetics, is it?
The subject of death is a big topic. I'm really interested in the holistic philosophy, and I'm also looking into other cultures. I'm interested in African culture. I'm also interested in Japanese culture. That's why I have some names from these countries.
What are your views on the way that we think about death in our culture? We tend to view it as quite a taboo subject within European culture particularly.
Yes, a lot of people are still frightened about this topic, and it needs some time till they find their own way to think about it and to find their own way to be brave enough to choose their own urn and to find a new way. And I would like to help people to think about it in a new way.
Have you got an urn yourself?
Yes, I have my personal urn, but it also changes sometime because I always develop new urns. So it's quite difficult to say. My children sometimes are playing with it even.
And when you say that your children play with it, do they realize what it is? Is death something that you can talk about easily within your family?
Yes, it's very interesting to talk with children. They have a very natural way. They are not frightened about it.
You were recently nominated for the International Funeral Award in 2008. How was the feedback from the rest of the international funeral industry to these designs, which are really quite cheerful and quite upbeat?
It was really great to be nominated at the funeral award, but I'm not sure if they really understood the idea of Cosmic Ball. Sometimes I think they are still quite old-fashioned, and they need some time to get used to this modern way of thinking about death and urns and these new objects.
My thanks to Thomas Scheer from Cosmic Ball in Zurich. After the break, we'll be hearing from British artist Runa Islam, who was nominated for this year's Turner Prize, about her new exhibition of film installations in Switzerland. So join me when we come back to Swiss by Design. Now, she may have missed out on a Turner Prize at the beginning of the week, but Runa Islam, the Bangladesh-born and British-raised film artist, was nonetheless celebrating the Swiss opening of her exhibition, Restless Subject, this week. This is the first solo exhibition by the artist in Switzerland, on show at the Kunsthaus in Zurich and the Museum Folkwang in Essen. Born in 1970 in Dakar, Islam lives and works on her film and art installations in London. The title, Restless Subject, focuses on the individual in society and draws on the use of cinematic themes and 16mm film to create feeling.
In addition to four of her recent films, the Kunsthaus also features one created specially for the event. I met with Runa Islam, who told me about her journey from more traditional art forms to her use of film.
More and more I'm sort of making film installations, and that's something that's just sort of been born out of a lot of experimentation. And in fact, I've been recognised for the filmmaking, so I've made, you know, this year about six films. I mean, I came through into the art field in a kind of roundabout way, and then from the art arena of going to an academy where you weren't taught anything, you were just allowed to practice. From that, I forged my own way of working, and at the time I was working with really as many materials and mediums as possible. But now when I look back, it was always a process of additive, you know, like I would work with photography or found objects or text, things that weren't really made from zero, from a blank page. So I think film itself is also like, you, even though you have the blank screen to fill, as soon as you cast your lens on something, it's recording what's there. So it's not really like I'm creating from the depths of my mind. It's kind of a ready-made as well.
But I suppose also that enters into the argument that really nothing is that original anyway these days. And
right.
So there's a very, very kind of postmodern aspect to it.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of originality, I don't think I was ever trying to gain, you know, ground. It was coming from a very original point, but it was this idea of how do you already work with what's around you? Painting was something that I couldn't really focus in or attune myself to this type of skill. I like the way that the lenses and, you know, all this equipment that's sort of really 20th century like devices were beginning a language, and I just like the way that you could make something really quite simple and yet it would contribute almost something new, not original, but this renewed way of looking. And that's for me quite important, this idea of looking again. You know.
Have you settled on this kind of art as being your means of expression?
I wouldn't say that. I like the idea that I'm always in flux, and that the subject itself, whether it's the subject of the image in front of the screen, whether it's the film going through the camera, whether it's an artist changing their way of working, that's the restless subject for me. You know, it can be any of these constantly shifting and moving points of view.
How do you like to represent these roots of yours within your work, or is that a concern?
You know, we all are a patchwork quilt of all our experiences, so I would never say that being born somewhere else and being raised in, you know, another part of the world hasn't influenced my perception. So this idea of, you know, always knowing the knowledge of two points of views is actually something that's just reoccurred in my work since I began to work with films, or even like the very early works, just, you know, taking photographs which tried to portray something. Again, this idea of the contradiction or the implicit contradiction in the one object. And I like the way that a camera is really there, you know, like cinema language is designed to give us this idea of the point of view. And that's already like, you know, sort of such a huge manipulation. So I like to sort of like almost sort of take apart and loosen the fabric and just pick apart, you know, what's already sort of understood as a given. And maybe this also comes from, you know, having another perspective where you have to join in from the outside in.
You're creating, but as you said, you're not creating on a blank canvas. You're actually creating from bits of film.
Yeah.
It's very expensive equipment. How do you keep yourself going?
It's kind of a mystery how you do find yourself in the position that you are. And when you look back, it's more startling to think, you know, this is the route that you've taken. You know, it's almost like you're on a precipice. And it's different for everyone, so it's kind of like a treacherous route. But I think the great survival technique is just to always really keep focused on the idea, and I think you always find a way. If I think, like, 10 years ago, I didn't have any commissions, you know, like, that's such a luxury now, and how fortunate I've been to actually go straddle, like, three commissions. It's a modern-day patronage. It's not the same for every artist, and there's similar situations that I can recognise in young artists who have to really, you know, almost like throw themselves into an unknown environment, and also the competition there, you know, it does get tougher and tougher. But, you know, I never try to think about that survival, because you know how everybody makes a way through. If you take away the opportunity to make, say, something, this year I made a film in 35mm, which was just completely wonderful to have the support to do that. But if you take that away, I can use another, you know, medium. And if you take that away, I'll use something else, you know. And it's this sense of that no matter how much you're diminished, if you've got the ideas, you can sort of maneuver yourself to create something.
The artist Runa Islam talking to me there. And if you'd like to see her Restless Subject exhibition, then you can catch it at the Kunsthaus in Zurich and the Museum Folkwang in Essen until the 8th of February next year. And coming up, I'll be talking to the architects of Switzerland's most eco-efficient office block. So stay tuned to World Radio Switzerland's Swiss by Design.
Swiss by Design is brought to you by Karen Millen Boutique, fashion for women, 7 Cours de Rive, Geneva.
Welcome back to the show. With melting glaciers an ever-present reminder of climate change in Switzerland, one Fribourg-based architect's practice has made it their mission to design buildings which have a minimal impact on the environment. The green offices in Fribourg not only absorb more greenhouse gases than were created during their construction, but 94% of the energy used in the building is renewable. Electricity is wind-powered, water is heated by solar panels, and rooms are heated with a wood pellet-fired boiler. And for those who are feeling the pinch during the financial crisis, the energy-saving statistics at green offices are enviable. This award-winning three-story building heats the full 1,300 square meters of space for just 680 francs a year. It's figures like this that have led to the award the Watt Door Prize for Switzerland's best energy-saving project. Carol Arleiter from Lutz Architects, the designers, who also have their office in the green offices, told me more.
So the green offices is the first building in Switzerland which is labeled MinergieP Eco. That means that the administrative building is the most efficient building in Switzerland related to sustainable development, and therefore the less demanding ever built in our country. And the aim was to realize a construction that could be an example and to show people that it is possible today, technically and but also financially, to build such a building with very little environmental impact. I can tell you, for instance, that for the heating and ventilations, we're just at 7% of what a standard building in Switzerland would cost 2007. So it's really, really low. The energy consumption for the building of the green offices is 1 million kilowatt per hour. If I take the same building, I mean, if I take a building with the same size, but built with traditional materials like concrete, like insulation based on oil products, aluminium windows, or synthetic paint, we would have used 2 million kilowatt per hour, so twice as much. And the difference, so this 1 million kilowatt per hour difference, would be sufficient to heat the green offices during 100 years.
You have the offices of the architecture practice within the building itself. How is it, or what's it like actually living within it?
It's really comfortable. You really feel well. I think you can feel that everything is natural. You know, even the smell of it. You can smell wood, and it's just wonderful.
Do you think that this is an exceptional building, or is it likely that now we have this building that more architects and developers in Switzerland will start to employ sustainability as their main criteria?
Yeah, I think this is an exceptional building. It is an example. We already see in Switzerland, and maybe even more in the northern countries, but also all over the world, that sustainability is becoming a crucial theme. And here at the green offices, we can say that it is one another concern.
Why do you think that it's taken so long for architects and developers to get the environmental message, especially in a country like Switzerland, where you can see melting glaciers, for example? Why is it taken so long for people to jump on board?
The German part of Switzerland has maybe a better knowledge than we do in terms of sustainability. It is not quite the same because they are at least more preoccupied than we are, and they are directly influenced by countries like Germany, which is further developed in this concern. So in the French part, architecture schools don't really care, I would say. And they don't really see the urge of teaching those concepts, which is unfortunate. Colleagues don't want to know about energy conceptions, and they don't want to communicate further with their colleagues who collaborate with them. It's quite a shame.
Do you see that situation improving in the future, or is there always going to be this divide between the German-speaking region and the French-speaking region in terms of their architectural sustainability?
It's more likely to become everyone's concern. Look at the world. Look at the worldwide energy concerns. It is crucial that we ask what we are doing with our energy consumption. About 35% of the global amount of energy is used for heating houses and buildings. So today we have the knowledge. Today we have the technique. Today we have the materials we need to lower the consumption. It is really simple to apply this in new buildings. I think everything's going to be better in a few years. But we have to let people get used to this idea.
Carola Leiter from Lutz Architects, designers of the most fuel-efficient office block in Switzerland, the Green Offices in Fribourg. Join me after the break when I'll be highlighting the top three cultural events over the country this week when we come back to Swiss by Design on World Radio Switzerland. Now, given the latest cold snap, going out may well be the last thing on your mind, but there are still all sorts of cultural events going on around the country. So to tempt you, here's the Swiss by Design guide to the coming week's highlights. The Migros Museum in Zurich is showing paintings by British artist Dawn Meller, whose pictures of celebrities have been described as grotesque and satirical. Characterized as a mix of underground trash, surrealism and pop art, each image reflects her black humor. The exhibition runs until the 15th of February next year. And on Thursdays, entry is always free after 5 o'clock in the evening. Basel's Museum Kleines Klingenthal presents Arbeitswelten, a collection of photos capturing the working side of the city. Shot between 1900 and 1980, the images come from the city's archives and depict the many different occupations and nationalities of city dwellers. The show ends on the 31st of May next year. And finally, in Geneva, the Theatre La Comédie welcomes 60s legend Marianne Faithfull, who's reading 30 of her favourite Shakespeare sonnets to the accompaniment of cellist Vincent Segal. These days more of a literary figure than a rock and roll hellraiser, Faithfull hopes to reignite the debate over Shakespeare's gender with her choice of poems. The reading takes place on Tuesday the 9th of December at 8 o'clock. Well, I'm afraid that's all we have time for on this edition. I hope you've enjoyed the show. Join me next week when I'll be asking why there's a huge pink poodle on Zurich City Hall, as well as exploring more of Switzerland's cultural and creative scenes. So tune in again. You've been listening to Jennifer Davies with Swiss by Design on World Radio Switzerland.
Swiss by Design is brought to you by Karen Millen Boutique, fashion for women, 7 Cours de Rive, Geneva.